Welcome to the GVA Legal Podcast. My name is Jean Kambuni and I'm your host. On today's episode, we are celebrating International Women's Day. March 8th was International Women's Day, a day that needs no introduction. You couldn't have missed all the social media campaigns. And in line with tech, this year's the UN International Women's Day is digital, innovation and technology for gender equality. International Women's Day 2023 will explore the impact of the digital gender gap on widening economic and social inequalities. In studio with me is a leading lady in tech, Grace Murugi. She is the head of digital strategy at Oxfam International and a finalist in this year's Top 40 Under 40. Yay! Welcome, Grace.
Thank you so much, Jean. Really happy to be here.
I'm going to jump straight into the topic and begin with a general question. So a lot of reference is made to the term digital divide, quote unquote. What does that term mean? Just explain it to us lay people.
So first of all, I'm really happy to be here. Digital divide is basically a form of inequality, is what I would say, when it comes to access to technology, and that normally would include phones, smartphones, tablets, and the internet in general. But the bigger picture when it comes to talking about digital divide is what is the ripple effect that follows in terms of access to information, access to resources, and then eventually ending at earning capacity as a result of that. And so anytime we have a conversation about that, we normally divide it into two broad categories. Access divide is the first one, and this is where the socioeconomic differences between that bring a difference in terms of income between like one person and the next, that defines access to devices, general infrastructure, data, etc. So the first thing is like access. Do we have access to technology? And then the second one is usage, and usage can be quite wide. So what I'm calling usage divide. So how equipped are people to make the best use of technology? So for example, if someone has a device in the internet, how well equipped are they to be able to gain information that can change their lives, increase their earning capacity, etc.? And I think one of the things we keep being told, Jean, is how, and I know you have a smartphone and so do I, we keep being told is that we utilize only 40% of our smartphone's capability, right? So I think that's broadly how I would answer the question on what a digital divide is.
Now, one of the things that is very interesting is COVID. So COVID exposed a lot of things and a lot of inequalities, but how did it expose the gravity of the digital divide, especially as you referenced my smartphone? How did COVID show that divide?
So I think the first, I would probably break this down into two. The first one is education, yeah? And I think in Kenya, we really saw like a very big divide in terms of that. And this is because of access to continuity of education. There's a report that I was reading that was saying that access to continuity of education was available only to 12% of the global population, which is really, really low. Yeah. I remember talking to a good friend of mine called Sami on this. He's very passionate about education. And is very concerned about like what happens there. And so we actually just unpacked this report and we couldn't believe like how the numbers were. And national school systems have had to catch up, right? We've seen that in the last 2 to 3 years. And as this national school systems are catching up, what's happening in the global curriculums is that a lot of them went on almost unaffected. Yeah. So we had all these Cambridge system schools and all that, just to remember how guys switched back to Zoom classes and Google Meet classes and things like that. So education, that showed us the divide like right before our eyes. Yeah. So it was very, it was very interesting to observe that. I think the second thing I would say is access to work. Yeah. So some jobs were able to pivot into like working from home and working online. And all that. Some businesses were able to also pivot to working from home, doing lots of deliveries, especially in the food sector. But then some of them were actually, unfortunately, not able to change and adapt. And so some of them, unfortunately, ground to a halt as a result of COVID. So I think the two things that I would talk about that exposed the digital divide, not just in Kenya, but also at a global scale, were education and then access to work.
That's very true. And I feel like the thing that COVID showed us is that the digital divide is layered on other divides. So like there's an income divide that becomes exacerbated and that digital divide layers on top of that. So the more access you have to disposable income, the more likely you have more digital technology, the more likely you are to be able to access services, even when the formal way of meeting and working and going to school was curtailed because of a global pandemic. So the next question I want to do is now dial down onto the digital divide. And I find it interesting that already there's so many divisions in it, but that there is a gender dimension to that divide. Mm-hmm. How wide is the digital gender gap?
Ooh, it's staggering. And I think it's very unfortunate. So say we are 8 billion people in the world right now, according mm-hmm. to, I think, the statistic from mid last year. So from this number, we have approximately 2.7 billion people who don't have access to the internet. Yeah. And I think for 2022 into 2023, there's a very big number. And the unfortunate thing is that the majority of this are actually women and girls. So this digital gender gap continues expanding in many developing countries. And unfortunately, what this does is that it creates like a specific need to support the gap. So I think the report that I saw was a World Economic Forum report for 2022. And it stated that 62% of men are using the internet compared to 57% of women. Yeah. So now, and I know, Jean, you followed this conversation of what's happening in the Middle East. So you can yes. only imagine that these numbers are dire. Yeah. So I think it's very, very unfortunate that we'll be talking about numbers like this. In Kenya specifically, I think the reports that are out there are more inclined towards jobs. And the report that I was reading said that when it comes to jobs, women occupy less than 30% of technology positions in Kenya and East Africa, which is very, very small. So there's so much like work to be done to be able to close the digital gender gap. There's a lot of work, and it's like a combined effort. But there's quite a bit of work to be done.
Now I'm going to expose myself here and say that while researching for this episode, I went down a YouTube rabbit hole and watched your interview for Top 40 Under 40, and one of the questions you were asked is what was one. I did. Mm-hmm. And on that interview, one of the questions you were asked is what are awesome. Your most memorable work experiences, where you mentioned your work in Safaricom
yes.
and one of your most memorable campaigns was the M-Pesa mm-hmm. campaign to get Kenyans to download the M-Pesa app. Yeah. And during that campaign, what did you find were the barriers that were preventing women from accessing the internet or from accessing any other digital technology?
Okay, so this is a really good question. And I would say the main barrier is the varying income levels in the country. So we'll find that men will do a job and then they'll get paid something like a certain amount of money, and then women will do, you know, a similar job and they'll get paid a different amount. And so I think the varying income levels definitely becomes like a barrier for women trying to access the internet, especially because to access the internet, you need devices, but also you need to spend money in terms of access through either Wi-Fi in the house or through data on your mobile device. And so those would be the biggest barriers that are preventing women from accessing the internet. And Safaricom, while I was there, did a lot of good work to be able to bridge this gap, but not just for women, from a general perspective, getting people to access smartphone devices at an affordable cost. So there was even a product where we were allowing people to pick a smartphone device from one of the shops, and then you just pay for it slowly. It was called Lipa Mdogo Mdogo. And so those are some of the initiatives that really helped to be able to bridge this gap. And I think the other thing I would mention is the World Economic Forum report. And one of the things that just really surprises me is that yeah. the report states that it'll take a decade to close the income gap globally.
Yeah.
And so once we've been able to, like, say the nonprofit world has done its bit, governments have done their bit, commercial entities have done their bit, we'll be able to close this gap and therefore lower the barriers for women accessing technology and the internet.
What I find interesting is that one of the main barriers you're saying is just access to finances. So as a bare minimum, you should be able to have enough disposable income to see that a smartphone, even a feature phone, is not only a luxury, but mm-hmm. a necessity. So that's one of the main barriers. Did you find any cultural contexts or biases that limited women from accessing these resources in any other way?
So there are parts of the country that I would say are still very patriarchal. And so like the person who would have, like say in a household where you can, where in a household you'll find a man has like a smartphone and then the lady in the house has a feature phone. Now, the things that the man can be able to do, I think like in the COVID year, one of the things that we saw is that smartphone penetration created new jobs, yeah? So suddenly there's Uber Eats, there's Jumia Foods, there's all these things. And like a boda boda was no longer like a boda boda. A boda boda was now somebody who was earning like say 3-4 times of what they would have earned previously, right?
That's
just
true.
Because they have a smartphone and they have access to internet, right?
Yeah.
Now, when you look at like now the other side of the story, so what does this mean for a woman? So if a woman has a smartphone, like how can we educate her to be able to get jobs that can increase her income the same way it happened for the men? You know, yeah. So there's always that conversation for, okay, so the man is empowered and is able to do all these other additional jobs and deliver food and everything, which is what happened during the COVID season. But then now on the flip side, what is happening to the woman? You know, so those are now the kind of conversations that we should be having to be able to close the gap.
And I think I like where you're taking us. You're taking us on to the next question that I had for what was the effect of that digital gender gap, and talking about that inability to access employment opportunities, I think is one of those. Mm-hmm. So if I could just generally ask, what was the then positive, negative, and I think in this instance, it was negative effect of the digital gender gap.
So it's a really, really good question. The layer I would add to this question is, what is the cost of excluding women? So we have a country that is divided into let's say it's 50% men, 50% women. So then now what is the cost of excluding women? Yeah. So a woman is in her own right, like an income earner. Yeah. And so the main effect that this would have is that it would hinder like economic growth and development, not just for her, but also for her family, for her community, for her society, and then eventually for the country. And so I think the cost of excluding women is that economic power. So I think that would be the main effect. And so unfortunately now it has a ripple effect. So if like say a woman is not able to earn today, then you know she has daughters, are they going to be able to earn during that time? And so it goes on and on like that, yeah. But I think the main effect is that we have less income as a country. And so when we look at say things like GDP and everything, like we have a gap there that can be filled simply by educating a woman in technology and allowing her to be able to use technology to increase her earning capacity.
Yes. And I think now I want us to try and look forward and see what we can do. And as your current job as head of digital strategy for Oxfam International, part of your work requires you to develop those strategies that will address these digital inequalities. So what can we do to bridge the gender divide in Kenya and in Africa at large? What specific strategies can we apply?
Yani, this is such a beautiful conversation. It can go on and on. I would say that it's not a one man's job or one woman's job. I would say it's a combination of efforts. Yeah. And this combination of efforts would need to come from, say, first of all, the government, because, you know, the government has the capacity and the power and the, you know, to be able to just cause that kind of change. Then we have us, the nonprofit world, that can be able to do our bit. And we also have other commercial entities like we've discussed the telcos. And so if all this, and there are so many other factors, yeah, and so many other entities, but if everybody can sort of come together and hold their inch in bridging this divide, I think would be good. So for example, nonprofits would do the work of influencing and creating awareness on the issue. So you'll see like now this week and into this month, a lot of non-profits are talking about International Women's Day, International Women's Month. There's a lot of, you know, conversations happening around that. And basically just creating awareness on the issue and the gaps and everything that you know, just the things that, just exposing what is happening. So nonprofits would do that. Governments can regulate the cost and access of technology to include women. Yeah. I'm going to be bold and say governments can consider not taxing women who have tech jobs. or exploring like a smaller tax margin on women who have tech jobs to just encourage women to join the field. Yeah, you see where I'm going with this conversation. Governments can also regulate the cost and access of technology for women. Okay. Governments can also create initiatives like, say, digital training and things like that, basically targeting women where they showcase the benefits of like being online, not just for, you know, entertainment and, you know, all these other purposes, but being online as an income generating tool. Yeah. So I think there's quite a bit of work that can be done if everybody sort of comes together or holds their inch. I've talked about the tax margins for governments for women in technology. So I think those are the things that we can do. One of the biggest trends we've seen post-COVID is the rise of this person being called a digital nomad, right? And we've talked about the picky person and, you know, how he's, you know, changed his world just by embracing technology and embracing the internet and everything. You know, so how do we bring this rise of the digital nomad to include the woman, yeah, where she's able to work from home and she's able to do all these things and become like a female entrepreneur and then eventually closes the wage gap. Yeah. So I would say it's like a combination of efforts between different entities and everybody holding their inch to close this gap.
I do like what you said about us all having a part to play, whether you are in government, whether you're in the development world, whether you're in civil society, or even whether you're in business, everybody has a part that they can do to close that gap. And if they all hold their individual section of the bridge, then they'll be able to close the gap. And one of the things that I hadn't thought about is exactly what I was saying before, tax incentives. Government uses tax incentives for businesses all the time. Why not use them in a creative and innovative way to enable more women to be able to work in tech? If you know you'll get paid less, you'll get to pay less taxes. I will be incentivized to up my credentials.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Grace. And that brings us to the end of this episode. I'd like to thank my guest, Grace Murugi. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I've loved this conversation a lot. I really have. So thank you.
Thank you. And I think we'll do a take two. Now, for our final segment, we'll take a look at our book of the week. Our book of the week this week is Daring Greatly by Brené Brown. The full title of the book is Daring Greatly: How the Courage to Be Vulnerable Transforms the Way We Live, Love, Parent, and Lead. This book is a culmination of Brené Brown's decades of research and hundreds of interviews on the concepts of shame, weakness, and vulnerability. The big idea in this book is that to have real social connections, we must embrace our vulnerability and imperfection. The author says, and I quote, "Rather than sitting on the sidelines and hurling judgment and advice, we must dare to show up and let ourselves be seen. This is vulnerability. This is daring greatly." In the book, the author explains how vulnerability is the greatest measure of courage. She also identifies the things we do to shield ourselves from vulnerability, such as perfectionism, numbing ourselves, being a constant victim, or on the other hand, being dominant. And the final one that I personally struggle with, foreboding joy. What is foreboding joy? Let me explain it in this way. When something is going right in your life, like you're in a good relationship or your marriage is doing well or your kids are healthy or so are your parents, then you get this feeling of foreboding and you think, this feels too good to be true. Something bad is going to happen. That is foreboding joy. And while bad things do happen sometimes, there's an antidote to foreboding joy, and that is gratitude. That's being grateful for what you have in that moment, for your family, for your friends, and for the connections that you have. And I'm working on it. In closing, I'd like to talk about the title of the book a little bit, and it's borrowed from a statement made by former US President Theodore Roosevelt in a speech that he gave in, wait for it, 1910. And it's an excellent work of writing, and I will read it to you to inspire you to, at the very least, read this book. It says this: "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbled or where the doer of deeds could have done better. The credit belongs to the man in the arena whose face is marred by the dust, sweat, and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes short again and again, who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, and spends himself in a worthy cause, who at best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly. That is a really good piece of writing. That brings us to the end of this episode. I am your host, Jean Kambuni. Tell us what you think about this episode in the comments section of our social media pages or on email. Our email address is info@gvalawfirm.com. You can also follow Gikera and Vat Gamma Advocates on social media. You can find us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as GVA Law Firm. Thank you for joining us on the GVA Legal Podcast. Let's get free.